DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know and you can't find the call on the radio, call the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
Just one click to hear it all.
Boba, boba, bloody bo.
Hello and welcome to White Line Wireless's continuing series about the Australian Imperial Force 11. If you don't know anything about this series and what it's about, I really would encourage you to listen to the introductory episodes, and that will explain how this is working. This is part of my PhD thesis, and so there's a few different elements to it, ways you can help me out, ways you can better enjoy it. First and foremost, if you are not listening to this on my website, you can read along with Cow Corner's Diary on anthonycondon.com and see where I've got my sources and references, get a whole lot of extra rich content. But today, we are up to week 6 of the tour, the 22nd of June, and I once again have Russ Degnan in the box of dreams with me.
Hi, Anth.
How are you going, Russ?
I'm good.
That's good to hear. So we had we were down in Sussex for our last game. Sorry.
Manchester,
that's right.
We've crossed the Pennines.
Yep. So from Manchester across to Yorkshire, and it's Bramall Lane at Sheffield, the 16th, 17th and 18th of June, 1919. So 3-day match here. And on the website, I have a scorecard that you can have a look at that I have recreated of the time. It's quite interesting to see how I've modelled on the scorecards you would get given to you on as you walked into the gate, where you would have the players' names printed down and you could fill it out yourself. And so this is Cow Corner's scorecard from the time, and you can jump in and have a look at that on the website. But now, on with Cow Corner's tour diary. This week began at Bramall Lane with a keenly anticipated meeting against the County of the White Rose. The county, as they're known up here, you can, to use an idiomatic turn of phrase, were initially inclined to look upon the visit as one of the least attractive of the fixtures. However, an undefeated run thus far have proved the Colonials to be a very hot lot. The Yorkshire players are quite keen on playing against the Travellers and are very desirous of being the first to lower their colours. Adding to the excitement was that this was the first opportunity Sheffield people had of seeing first-class cricket since 1914. Except for a match with the Yorkshire Council, the County 11 have not been seen at Bramall Lane since the first month of the war, when the game with Middlesex was played after notice of abandonment had been given. While some who were not cricket enthusiasts were tempted to attend the match of a visiting colonial touring team as a matter of curiosity, and many others to introduce themselves to their county's young talent, the highlight for most of us was seeing those two doyens of the English 11, Wilfred Rhodes and George Hurst. Neither disappointed, taking runs and wickets. This should have seen Yorkshire secure the win, but a remarkably fine display of coolness and skill, splendidly representative of true colonial grit, saw Gregory and Long, typical of the Australian spirit, refuse to acknowledge defeat, and they scraped home by one wicket. At this point, the crowd, although Podsnapian, gave an ovation of true sportsmanship and joy at the return of big cricket. One old hand recalled it was like the happy old pre-war days to see nobility rubbing shoulders with the commoners on the benches amongst the 7,000 people sitting in the glorious sunshine. Although not up to the giant crowd seen here in 1909, it was very satisfying to see a crowd similar to which the Australians are accustomed to when visiting home. Many see county cricket on its trial this season, and indeed, our lot are revealing the keenest anxiety for the resumption of international contests. If what has been seen in the match between Yorkshire and the Australians at Bramall Lane during the past 3 days is part of that trial, it ought not to be difficult to find a following for the game. Indeed, some local cricketers who were watching the Yorkshire-Australian struggle declared that it is years since they endured such exhilarating agony. They could not sit still.
So this is a very interesting side. Yorkshire, of course, is one of the strongest county sides over a very long period of time, and this was no exception. And Wilfred Rhodes not a young man at this point. He's 40, 42. Hurst is 47, I think. So getting well in age. And that comes out of the discussion. But the name that jumps out for me, of course, is in the middle of the order, which is Herbert Sutcliffe,
yep,
who's probably not played much cricket at all to this point. He's born in 1894. He's in his early 20s. Didn't score, didn't do much in this game, hasn't there. But he's the player that goes on to become such a giant of the game, of course.
Yeah, so yeah, Herbert Sutcliffe has... He's only just recently debuted. First match was about a month before. So only, you know, a handful of games under his belt at most. So Cal Corner wouldn't have had any reason to have been talking about this young kid in particular. And so to get a little bit behind the scenes of what I'm doing, that's one of those decisions that I have to weigh up. And so, for example, there's a time when they play against Dallas Brooks. And Dallas Brooks goes on to have a memorial hall in Coburg named after him because he's the longest ever serving Victorian Governor General. And I can't really... I really wanted to sort of get that in without it feeling anachronistic, but he did have quite a good service record. So I was able to sort of say, you know, I was able to bring him in. And I probably should talk about this in that episode, but I mentioned that, you know, we'll see. I have no doubt we'll see him again on our, you know, you'll see him on our shores soon. And that's about as far as I would go into. I call them anachronistic winks. Mm-hmm. So I know something you don't know, and that's kind of part of the methodology that I'm actually doing, is about being really aware of where I am as well as where my imaginary author is, and that I get. It's called the Jetzeits, the now time. So when we're doing this in history, it's being very aware that I am writing in 1919, in 2019. And so I'm allowed to do that, but I don't want to do it too much so that it really destroys the illusion and starts to become a little bit corny and hammy. So, yeah, so Herbert Sutcliffe, right at the start of getting back to the cricket, Herbert Sutcliffe, right at the start of his career.
And Wilfred Rose and George Hurst, right at the end of their careers. It would have definitely seemed like the good old days. Wilfred Rose and Percy Holmes have put 150 for the first wicket.
Yeah.
It's obviously probably glorious midsummer sunshine for Yorkshire or something like that. But they've collapsed after that. They've been bowled out for 224. Gregory's taken 6 for 91. So those two to the top for the bowling for Australia, Collins and Gregory, consistently day in, day out, basically taking the wickets.
Yeah, and we mentioned this in earlier episodes, how Gregory's pretty much unknown at this point, and he's one of the Gregorys, the famous cricketing family, but he had left and gone off to the country and didn't want to have anything to do with cricket, and this sort of gets him back into it, and of course he goes on to be a true legend of the 1920s Australian side, probably the best all-rounder of the 1920s.
Australia's collapsed in their follow-on. They were at one point 3 for 22, but they scrambled together a bunch of runs. There's not a lot of centuries in the Australian, in any of these games that we've seen. They're not scoring. There's a lot of 40s and 30s and so forth. And in this case, Trenery's got 54, but it's Gregory's batting at 9. He's got 30. They've dragged them to 265, a little bit of a lead.
Yeah, like a lot said about the modern bats and how much they've changed the game. But as we mentioned in the previous episode, we're not even in a world of covered pitches yet. So getting a century on wickets that don't get covered ever, and I am sure that Bramall Lane would have had a bowling green, an absolutely perfect wicket, but... It would have suffered over the course of the game, that's for sure. And so, yes, getting the bigger scores, it is a lot less regular in these times.
I think Bramall Lane is used for football as well, though. So, and not used up often for first class. It was mentioned in the diary entry that hadn't been a while since they'd played a first class game there 5 years. So, it may have been one of those. Maybe the pitch isn't perfect. It's got situations.
Yeah. Sheffield United, that's right. It is. Sheffield Wednesday, and that's Sheffield United. So I'd hosted a test match in 1902 in Bramall Lane, but that's its only solitary test match. So yes, it was almost out of its cricket career by now, and they're still playing on it into the 40s, but there's not much going on after that. So 1981, the cricket pavilion was demolished.
It was one of those. It's one of those grounds that a football ground that has was originally kind of in a weird shape because it's got football stands and cricket stands, and then over time, football being the bigger, much bigger sport in England and much more professional, yep. and not having those opportunities to get crowds in, week out, has meant that it's become a purely football ground now. And you only kind of know it when you look at the scorecards and say, Bramall Lane, they were playing cricket there? That's weird. But, yeah, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, that's a different scenario.
And also, and I've mentioned this in previous episodes, that this is a period right after the war where all the grounds are trashed because, you know, they were growing potatoes on Lord's. So had to get the potato patch out before the start of the cricket season, but it was there the previous one. All right, so before we go through the second innings on the scorecard, we'll just go back and let Cal Corner finish off his tale of the Yorkshire match. The story of the week is once more told in one word: barrackers. And I thought Englishmen, hampered and bound by every sort of tradition, did not barrack. As Ted Long was about to take the arena, a member of the crowd facetiously said, "I'll bet you a fiver Australia is beaten." Ted stopped and clinched the bet and then strode to the wickets. He walked up to Collins and said, "Guy bet me a fiver we wouldn't do it, so I'll hold my end up while you make the runs." The bet was won, and Long and Collins saw that no one paid for a drink until a check of accounts showed that the fiver had been spent. I love that there's some on-field gambling on the game that goes onto the bar tab after the match. I think that's entirely appropriate. I think any player should be able to gamble on the game they're playing in.
With
spectators, as long as any winnings from said bet goes onto the combined team's bar tab at the end of the night. And you would end up with some Harlem Globetrotters-esque cricket, I imagine.
I like the implication that English people don't barrack. It's that construction of Englishness and English cricket that's so Lord-centric, so MCC, so staid.
It is hilarious.
Whereas as soon as you get north into Yorkshire, into Lancashire, it's nothing like that. It's the Lancashire leagues are nothing like that. The Yorkshire leagues are nothing like that. And Yorkshire cricket has never really been like that. This is it's got its own traditions. For decades and decades until very recently, it never had overseas players. It would never even take players from other counties who were born there. You had to be, you know, die and...
I spent the early part of my research for this thesis living the one street over from Headingley, and really immersing myself, because I really wanted to get in there and understand Yorkshire cricket, because it is something different than what's going on in the south. And I really love it. It feels a lot like support for Collingwood football team in Australia, where there's everyone sort of looks down upon you as the trash, but there's this definite, not a sense of superiority, but a knowledge of superiority that is in there as well. It's quite interesting. I love how sport brings out those kind of sentiments in people. And it's like, well, you know, you guys rag on us all day long because most of us are miners or even the wealthy ones amongst us are new money, and there's not this long aristocracy like you guys, but better at you than cricket.
Yeah, and you need our bowlers when we come and play for England.
Yeah, you need some of those coal miners. I also wanted to point out here with the diary, if you jump on the website, the line, "And I thought Englishmen hampered and bound by every sort of tradition did not barrack." You can click through there to a newspaper article, which is a transcript of a toast Sir Archibald Weigel, the governor of South Australia, gave it a valedictory dinner for the 1920 English Ashes side. I had to sort of pick one sentence out of it, and you really need to go and read that whole two paragraphs or so around that sentence. It is quite enjoyable in its sense of Englishness. Yeah, and so you can click through and have a read, but I might just read a paragraph out of it now. So he told the English players, so he's giving a toast to the cricketers in Adelaide, the English cricketers. He told the English players that the two great national games in the Commonwealth were cricket and speech-making. He said the English visitors had a tremendous opportunity of doing much good for the empire. And this is in 1920. They could either help or hinder the relations that existed between those who were at the center and those who lived on the circumference of the empire. And this is really interesting because this goes to what this tour is largely about. It's this knitting together of the empire after this shaking of the war. And this guy, and you know, Sir Weigel, Governor General at this time, is an Englishman. So he's got these Englishmen over and he's like, this is Australia, gents. Like, we need to behave appropriately so that we continue to build the bonds of empire. Your ambassadors. They would learn a great deal from Australia, and possibly on the field they might be able to teach Australians something. Each team would be able to do something for the benefit of the other. It might be presumption on his part, but he would like to give them a little advice. Australian crowds were very independent. He had not been long in the state before he learned that. In his wanderings through the country, he had gone among all classes and creeds, and he was perfectly certain that any comment, however outspoken, would not be made in any such spirit that they in England would term not playing the game. So he's basically saying, look, they are going to give you shit the whole way. But it's good-natured shit. They just haven't, you know, it's what passes for humour over here. Yes, and then it was due merely through over-keenness and a desire to see the other side win. There's much more I could go on. It's a great speech, well worth a read. It's in The Age, Wednesday, 10th November, 1920, page 9. Or go to my website, click through from there.
And it goes to that essence of the difference between Australian cricket and English cricket, doesn't it? Because Australian cricket has always been, like Australian society, a little less class orientated. It's got, we've taken cricketers, we don't have enough cricketers to just pick amateurs and have those playing. We would pick anyone from every society. We would barrack. English cricket's always said, no, we're above that, except when we're not. And Yorkshire's when we're not.
Yeah, except for when we need a fast bowler. But it's interesting you say that, because one of the conversations that Cam and I had was about, yes, Australian cricket's very egalitarian, but where cricket is not being drawn from everywhere. It is a very select group of people that are playing cricket then. And it's interesting, the demographics look a lot like the officer class. And so where they're drawing officers from for the military in the First World War is the same feeder system that they're drawing their cricketers from. It's the Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide private school system, basically. And so it's interesting because we have this idea of this egalitarian Australian cricket, but it is very class-based. And as I was saying before about how this, before the war, was like peak Australian identity stage, that was a lot of that late 19th century was when this whole idea of the egalitarian Australian, you know, cut down the tall poppies, sit in the front seat of the cab kind of idea comes about. So there you go. Teddy Long, Herbie Collins, made a stand, won a bet, shouted the bar. Back to Cal Corner's diary. The spirit of the AIF has not left the lads. We're developing into gamblers. Among ourselves, of course, except for the guy at the ground. The bug has bitten so deeply, indeed, that on the trip from one end of the nation to the other, to get us to Hampshire, finding ourselves without a deck of cards, Ted Long, who was one of the wits of the team, devised the scheme of betting on the electric fan that cooled the railway carriage. He stuck a piece of paper on the framework of the fan and gambled which blade would stop closest to the piece of paper.
It was the most primitive roulette wheel.
Yeah, I love that one because it really is reinforcing the stereotype of, you know, Australians are going to gamble on two cockroaches running up a wall kind of thing. But what else are you going to do on these really long train rides everywhere?
And probably more the point, what else were you doing for the last 5 years in the trenches?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and that's the, yeah, and then the, that's what he's referring to with the spirit of the AIF. The spirit of the AIF is basically always gambling. Just gamble. Gamble on everything that's going on.
It's extraordinary they didn't have a pack of cards, though. Something's gone horribly wrong.
Yes, and yes, it definitely has. The way that's coming across in the diary is that something had gone horribly wrong. So we might jump over and finish off our Yorkshire v Australia. So where are we as we open the second innings for us?
So Australia had taken a 41-run lead, having batted second, and the Yorkshires come back in. There's a couple of relatively early wickets. So 3 for 48. Holmes has again scored runs. He's got 47. George Hurst has come in. He's made 88, largely with the tail. There wasn't a lot of support around him.
No.
One retired hurt in there, and they've been bowled out for 210. So they've left Australia just on 170 odd to chase, 100, which they've done, but they've done it just. It's that,
just.
They would probably also say the spirit of the AAF was infusing this innings, because they've got down to the ninth wicket and they still needed a fair few runs. They were 116 with nine wickets down, so they still need another 54. Blackburn's taken wickets for Yorkshire. Took 5 for 60. Rhodes is bowling the crafty old man, but they've managed to just scrape by with Gregory's 41.
And I think this tale, this last session of cricket, is really important to this story. This is Yorkshire, and Yorkshire win the championship this year. So we have here this champion team with these champion players amongst them, and most importantly, it was a great game. Down to the wire, final wicket win. If we're putting this in the context of cricket reconstruction, is there really a point to international cricket anymore? Are people going to come along to the games? Well, cricket like this starts getting people along to the games again. So we'll jump back over to Cal Corner and his diary. The Hampshire game. We're Hampshire down at the county ground in Southampton. This is a two-day game, this one. The Hampshire game saw the young former Eton boy, if one can still call him a boy given his service, three times wounded and twice mentioned in despatches, and titles, Major the Honourable Lionel Tennyson, grandson of the poet of that name, play his first match against an Australian side. The war claimed so many of the county's cricketers as victims that they have had to practically rebuild the team. In total, they lost at least 18 first-class cricketers in the war, more than the 15 lost Australian Sheffield Shield players. Such was the depletion of the Hampshire side that Ledger Hill took the field for the home team. Hill first saw action against Australians, playing for Cambridge against Billy Murdoch's side in 1890, and hasn't played regularly for Hampshire since 1911. Another young Hampshire man, Dallas Brooks, got a deserved pat on the shoulder from our Anzacs when they discovered he had been wounded fighting alongside a number of them at Gallipoli. Like Trenery, he was seriously wounded in that battle. Half blown up when one of the jam tin bong catapults invented in the trenches failed. Docker also gave a cheeky mention that he'd been wounded in the desert. But Nip Pellew, who was CO of the 5th Battalion later in the war, and knew some of the men who served with Docker in that unit in Egypt, suggested he didn't really deserve any medals for it, as he'd fallen off his horse riding through the camp. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see too much of Brooks in the rain-affected match, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him gracing our fields in the not-too-distant future. Unfortunately, the 48 days drought at Southampton finally broke on the first day, meaning no cricket could be played. So the 2 days match ended in a draw. So, Russ, anything, before we get into some of what Cow Corner is talking about there, anything interesting from the scorecard here? It was a pretty much of a nothing game, this one. Oldfield grabbing himself a couple of stumpings.
Yeah, Oldfield wasn't the keeper in the previous game, and he's come in to the side. Oldfield was, of course, a very fine cricketer for Australia.
Yes.
In that interwar period. So he's taken over the gloves from Long, taken two stumpings early. But as you say, there's not a huge amount going on. You can look at the Hampshire lineup and see that the ages of the various cricketers in their 40s and late 30s, except for one or two. Bowled out for 191 in the first innings. Lampard was taking wickets, so presumably was taking a fair bit of spin as well. And then in Australia's response, they scored 136. So they were actually behind a reasonable amount, 54 runs. Trenery is the only real scorer there with 56. But they only got one wicket in the second innings. So it was never going to be a result.
No. But I think the really interesting part of this part of the diary is this really drives home the losses that the teams suffered in the First World War. So I think it ends up being more like 24 first-class Hampshire players died in the war. So people who played cricket for Hampshire in a first-class match. And at this stage, they know of at least 18. So that's more than the entirety of Australia. And I'm pretty sure that Hampshire ends up being the worst hit. But every side's like this. They've lost a dozen cricketers who could be in the first team. So it really is like everyone has lost their first team. They might have held a couple of stars and they've got a couple of kids. But
I think it impacted too the southern counties more so than some of the northern ones, which are more or less industrial based. And there's a requirement for them not to go to war.
Yeah, so yeah.
To work in the factories and the mines and do the
yep.
that job. Whereas Hampshire, well, why aren't you fighting for your country? Yep. Why aren't you going across? It's the nature. They were much more, had more amateurs in their side, so they're much more likely to sign up. So that's one of the reasons where they've had the more significant losses.
That's interesting. It might be worth doing a comparison, geographical comparison on how many they lost and yeah, because that makes sense. I hadn't thought of that the more industrial areas would have lost less because they had men in. In what do they call them? The necessary jobs. It's a phrase. Can't believe, but they had that. Yeah, they had men who were doing jobs that had to be done for the war machine.
And certainly, amateur cricketers were the most likely, I suspect, to sign up of anyone because they were the most likely to be given an officer
yes.
position and
yep.
and to have that opportunity. Well, not the opportunity, but the time, and that's why they're amateur cricketers in the first place. So, yeah. Hampshire. As it was, along with Kent, I think, was probably the other county you'd probably see a really large numbers of losses.
Definitely.
Are those two counties where you've got that really strong ethos of amateurism? And
yeah, well, that makes sense because one of the things I mentioned in the last podcast about with the subscription model is that the aristocratic class, you know, you're expected to be funding charitable societies and things like cricket teams and putting back into your community. That was part of being the landed gentry. And so that same sense of obligation was there in enlisting as well, where you had to, everyone sort of definitely seen as that's the role of the English gentleman was to go and become an officer in the English army at that stage. I also just wanted to point out this, one of the stylistic things I do in this one, because when I talk about Dallas Brooks and maybe we might see him again in the next. So Dallas Brooks actually goes on to be the first Victorian Governor General the longest serving Victorian Governor General. So he definitely does get out to Australia in the not too distant future. Doesn't have a brilliant cricket career, but I really tried to walk a fine line in how much I want to notice for the future. And So yeah, that sort of brings us to the end of Kaukaura's diary for 22nd of June. Russ, any final thoughts on that before we let our listeners go?
No, I'm intrigued to see where they go next. They've been up and down the country. So they were in Sussex, they've gone up to Lancashire, they've gone across to Yorkshire, and then they've headed all the way back down. It's a fascinating insight into the nature of those tours that they're just trying to squeeze games in where they're not supposed to be playing. County schedules were always a little malleable. They still are to some extent.
So they're in Hampshire, 21st of June. Well, the next week is an exciting one. So it's Gentlemen of England down at Lord's on the 23rd. So they've got a day to get from Hampshire back down to London. And then they're going to face the best of the amateurs in England. So join us for that next week. Remember, anthonycondon.com. You can see all these diaries on there with all the additional content. Tweet at me, at AnthCondon. Really love your feedback. Really want your feedback. It's useful for me, not just in making this show better, but also in writing my thesis and having something interesting to talk about there. So I'd really appreciate that. Thanks for joining me, Russ.
Thank you.
And we will see you next week.
Bloody ball.
The main of every true blue fan is the Bandex cricketer anchor man. It's the same old words in the same old voice. Long past time, there was another choice like the White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
White Line Wireless.
From the box of dreams, you're gonna hear the call. Oh, Bob, oh, Boba Bloody Bowl.